All right. Let's get into our text tonight, 1 Samuel 4 and 5. All right, let's turn this thing on and get started. It's wonderful to have a text that isn't controversial and no one will disagree with. All right, let's get started. How do we classify this book? What did we teach you a couple weeks ago? This is a what? Yes, it's a theological narrative or a theological historical narrative. Now, why are we putting that word theological in front of it as opposed to just calling it simply a narrative? What does this mean? Yell at me, please. Yes, we need to learn theology from this narrative. We're not reading it like a history book of the United States or some nation. This is going to inform our theology. This is a theological, historical narrative. Now, I need to remind you this verse in the past, 1 Samuel 2:12. Now, the sons of Eli were worthless men. The Net Bible translates it wicked. They did not recognize the Lord's authority. In chapter 4, God has not forgotten about these two losers and what they are doing. He's not forgotten about them. They are problematic, and we're going to find out what happens to them. Verse 1 and 2, now the word of Samuel came to all the Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Ephlech. The Philistines drew up a line against the Israel. And when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. This is a bad day in the life of Israel right here. When the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." From these verses right here on the screen, verse 3, what do we learn about Israel's perspective of who God is? Someone yell at me, please. I heard it. He's what? A good luck charm. I'm not sure about that. Anybody else? A pagan view of God. All right, the pagan view of God, is our God bigger than their God, etc. Notice what the elders ask. Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? They don't analyze their own strategies. They don't think, what could we have done better? Maybe we needed a better... What do they say? What do they conclude? It's God. It's a God issue. And they can't figure out why God would let them lose. So what is their solution to the problem? Bring the ark. Bring the ark up. Let's see. I got a picture of the ark here. Here it is. There's a picture of the ark. What does the ark represent? Somebody yell at me. What does the ark represent? God's throne, God's presence. We need to get God involved in this. Obviously, God wasn't close enough. God wasn't involved in some form or fashion. Now, commentators do not agree as to whether the syntax of the Hebrew language points to faith in the ark over God. In other words, is this a move the ark over here? Is this a acknowledgement of we need God on our side? Or is this like the ark is a good luck charm and we need to get it close? They don't agree on whether the Hebrew is clear on that or not. In other words, is this like, man, we believe God's powerful, and because we believe God's powerful, let's move the ark over here? Or is this like, obviously, the ark has power in itself. This box has power, and if we get the ark close enough, we'll have victory. There's not agreement as to that. The issue or the problem is in verse 4. The sin of Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas could no longer be ignored. Verse 4 says, "So the people sent to Shiloh and brought there the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. The two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God." Now, so now we've got the problem with the Ark. You get it? Because the men go with the Ark. They're all going together. So here it again, the picture of the Ark. "And as soon as the Ark of the Covenant, all the people came into the camp, all of Israel gave a mighty shout so that the earth resounded." All right, now you've got to get these details. They're pretty important. So the defeated army is now invigorated again because the ark comes marching by. This particular detail concerning the reaction of God's people to the presence of the Ark of the Covenant assures us that Israel's defeat was not for lack of motivation or morale. We're getting ready to have another giant defeat in just a minute in the narrative. But before we read about this, we're told that they are excited. They are motivated. They have an incredible morale right now. Likewise, the text goes out of its way to present all the human details from a Philistine perspective. We'll answer the question in just a minute, why does it? But let's look at 6, 7, and 8 first. 6, when the Philistines heard that the noise of the shouting, they said, "What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And when they learned that the ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "A god has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness." We'll make you guys the Israelites. We'll make you guys the Philistines, just so that we can get this picture. The ark comes marching in, and you guys just resound with an incredible morale of fight, rally. This creates like a rippling, and it gets over to here. And your initial reaction is, what in the world has just happened in this camp? We just defeated them with 4,000. They should not be rejoicing like this. What? And now you're expressing this great concern about the mighty gods of the Israelites, which is pretty interesting that it's a plural perspective because this is a monotheistic nation. And you've got some kind of history. You understand? This story of the past is in your mind. Notice the details in verse 9. The men are being encouraged to rally and fight hard. The potential of becoming slaves to the Israelites should be sufficient to motivate these men to fight to death. And by the way, they do. So now, next, here's the words in the Philistine camp. This is y'all, right here. "Take courage. Be men. O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you, be men and fight." So this side is rallying, and then somebody over here stands up to take a leadership role and says to all you guys, "If we don't fight to the death, we're going to become slaves." Now, let's answer this question. Why all these details? Why all these details? The details about you guys rallying about the ark, the details about you guys initially having this concern, and yet this concern reverses you and motivates you. We don't want to become slaves. Why does the text go out of its way to present all these details? All these details. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled every man to his own house. And there was a great slaughter for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel. 30,000! Just for perspective, that's almost twice the 82nd Airborne Division. Wrap your brain around that. You can't just read over 30,000. Plus the previous four, 34,000. In a week, in a short period of time. And I said to you that this was a theological narrative, that we're supposed to learn something from this, not just read it like we're reading a history book. And what I would suggest to you is that all these details remind us that our God works in and through humans. That he doesn't divorce himself from the humans, that he uses human emotion, human action, human motivation. I'm trying to show you, we've got an entire chapter that says, you guys are rallying over here that the Ark of the Covenant's there. That should be enough to ensure victory. Yet you guys over here, you guys pump each other up and say, we don't want to become slaves. We're going to have to fight to the death. And then we find out in the end, you won by defeating them to 30,000. Yet we have all these details. And I would suggest to you that while our God is in fact sovereign, we cannot lose sight of the fact that he works through human beings, that he works through men rallying, that he works through humans saying things, that he works through legitimate fighting. We don't have the Philistines over here cowering in the corner, and yet they're victorious. We don't have a disconnect. We have them doing exactly what we would expect them to do to be victorious. And yet we understand that their victory is because of God. Because the Ark of the Covenant was there. And we're going to see in just a moment in chapter 5 that the Ark of the Covenant is one powerful thing. But in this case, it didn't work. Verse 11 says, and the Ark of the Covenant was captured, and the two sons, Eli and Hophni and Phinehas, died. God's objective has been met. What do you mean by God's objective has been met? Look back at 2:25. Look back at 1 Samuel 2:25. This was a couple weeks ago for us. 1 Samuel 2:25. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. So the Philistines were doing God's will. That's the reality. But what about the other 30,000? 29,998. Would you look at, I think it's verse 17. Someone said yes? He who brought the news and answered said, Israel has fled before the Philistines. And there was a great defeat. It's not hard to understand how you wipe out 30,000 men when they're running for their lives. You understand? They fled. They didn't stay and fight. They fled. They utterly fled. What I'm trying to show you is that while we clearly understand that the victory is the Lord's and he's sovereign over all that happened, at the same time, the Israelites didn't even fight. Verse 17 is going to show us this. Verse 12 says, a man of Benjamin ran from battle that day and came to Shiloh the same day. On his clothes were torn and with him dirt on his head. The guy looks a mess. You can just imagine what he looks like. He arrives to Eli, who's sitting on his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the news came into the city and told the news, all the people cried out. They cried out. Can you imagine? Just put yourself in their shoes. In this congregation, all of you would be widows overnight. All of you. 30,000? The cry would have been incredible. The cry would have just been real. When the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. Eli heard the sound and he said, what is this uproar? The man hurried and came and told him, Eli. Eli was 98 years old and his eyes were set so that he could not see. So Eli cannot see what the man looks like. That's why we get the details of his clothes being ripped and his dirt on his head. The man said, I am he who has come from battle. I fled the battle today. He said, how did it go, my son? He who brought the news said, Israel's fled before the Philistines. There's been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. Now, we don't get it. How could we? The Ark of the Covenant is just something that we see on pictures. I'm not even sure what we could have in the church that would be so sacred as the Ark of the Covenant, John. I don't know that we have any symbol like it. I'm trying to get you somehow to put your imagination into the narrative and think for yourself that this golden box represents the single most sacred thing on the planet from your perspective.
Yeah, like if they burned all the Bibles.
Like they burned all the Bibles.
And you couldn't read a Bible.
And you could never get another Bible again in your life. That might be a small comparison. This is devastating. Please understand, in essence, what this means. Has God abandoned us as his chosen people? Like, how could God let us get defeated by 30,000? And how could God let his own ark be captured into pagan lands? I mean, where is God? Is God done with us? Remember, we're his chosen people. He has rescued us from Egypt, delivered us into the promised land. We have the covenant promise. Nobody else has this. And the Ark of the Covenant is the representation of that covenant. And where is it right now? It's in the hands of the enemy, who, by the way, just defeated us soundly. This is too much bad news in one day, in one moment of time. This is the worst imaginable thing that you can imagine. This is losing your children like Job chapter 1 and everything going. This is the worst of the worst. As soon as he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backward from his seat on the side of the gate and his neck was broken and he died. The man was old and he was heavy. Because we're trying to understand how did he fall backwards, and we're trying to understand how in the world did he break his neck, and that just doesn't make sense. Just because you fall off of a chair doesn't normally mean that you break your neck. But this is not a young man, this is an old man. And oh, by the way, this is not a physically fit man, this is an overweight man. And this is an overweight man enraged by all that's happened. He lost his boys, and he knows that he's responsible for losing his boys. He knows this. His guilt must have been incredible. He is the man that was supposed to stop their behavior. He's the one that told us. Do you remember this? Chapter 2, come on, y'all that were here on Sunday night. He rebuked them. He told them that they can't do what they're doing. And he got told that he's going to lose them both on the same day. And what happened? He lost them. And oh, by the way, the Ark of the Covenant had. And that's what tore him up. You're right, John. The Ark of the Covenant put him over the top. Because remember, he had judged Israel for 40 years. For 40 years. And this is the end of his time? This is how he goes out of office? The Ark of the Covenant is in somebody else's hands? Let me remind you, Moses and Joshua, and then followed by the 12 judges in the book of Judges. And then we have Eli for 40 years. And then we have Samuel. And after this, we're going to Saul, David, and Solomon. Now, his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth to her pains came upon her. Perhaps this is just a tiny little comparison. Wave at me if you can remember where you were when the Twin Towers came down. And don't you think you'll never forget that? Don't you think that for the rest of your life, even when you're old and in a nursing home, that you'll still be able to remember the day it came down? Where you were? What were you doing? How you first heard about it. I was in the Laflamme Dental Clinic. I don't even know if we still have a Laflamme Dental Clinic. And I saw it on the screens, the television. I'm trying to give you a comparison to what it would have been like to be there on that day to find out that the Ark of the Covenant has been captured into the Philistine hands. This daughter-in-law is giving birth, and in birth, she finds out about it. She's not even excluded from finding out about it. In birth, the news is spreading out. And about the time of her death, the woman attending her said, "Do not be afraid, you've borne a son." Which should have been the best news in the world. To bear a son meant that you have someone to carry on the family lineage. This is a man who's going to take care of you in your old age. This is really good news to have a son. She did not pay attention. You know why she didn't pay attention? Because she's overwhelmed by the fact that the Ark of the Covenant is in the enemy's hands. And she named the child Ichabod, declaring that the glory has departed from Israel because the Ark of the Covenant had been captured and her father-in-law and her husband are dead. Imagine this. This is a bad day. How can we grasp the magnitude of what is being described in verse 21? The glory has departed from Israel and the Ark of God has been captured. At this point in the story, the Ark appears to be powerless. Agreed or disagreed? It did not keep Israel from being defeated. Perhaps Yahweh isn't as powerful as originally thought. If you end the story right now, what do you think about Yahweh? If you end the story right now, what do you think about the Ark of the Covenant? It's pretty impossible for you to imagine this because you know the end. You know the next chapter. You know that Jesus is coming. You know that the victory occurs. You know that there's an eternal state coming. You know it all. So it's almost impossible for us really to get into the narrative. But just for a moment, pretend that you're doing this for the very first time and you don't even know the next day what's going to happen. How do you wake up as an Israelite and do anything when the Ark of the Covenant is in the hands of the enemy? Chapter 5 is a giant turning point. That's why we're doing it tonight. That's why we can't stop the story right now. In chapter 4, the ark seems powerless. Every Israelite knows what a big deal the ark is. The glory of the Lord has departed the land, or at least Shiloh. Now in chapter 5, we're going to see what a big deal the ark actually is. Chapter 5 is the vindication of Yahweh. Okay, as Nate said earlier in the message, he's not a localized deity. What do I mean by a localized deity? Well, Yahweh's your God, but we've got our God over here, and they're all God. No, you need to understand, our God is not a localized deity. Our God is the God of the universe. This is not Israel's made-up God, Yahweh. This is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and right now he's in your side of the camp. Now Yahweh crosses over the border into the land of Dagon. One idolater, Eli, has already been dethroned. Now it's time to dethrone another one. What do I mean by dethroned? Well, he was on his seat where he judged. And he came off that seat and his neck was broken and he's dead. In just a moment, the author's going to show us another Eli. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. The Philistines took the Ark of the God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. You get it? So again, we'll make the music stand Dagon. Music stands do a lot in our church. This is Dagon. This is his temple, his house. And here we are, we'll bring in the Ark. We'll bring in the Ark of the Covenant. So they carry in the Ark of the Covenant. And God allows them to carry it in. I say allows them because oftentimes when you touch the Ark, you die. But in this case, God allows them to live and they carry it right down into the house of Dagon. So now we're going to have the God of the Philistines and we're going to have the Ark of the Covenant, which is the representation of Yahweh. Are they parallel? Are they on par? Are they two localized deities battling it out? That's the point of the narrative right now. Because your God of the Israelites didn't do much for you on that day. You lost your ark, you lost your judge, you lost his boys, and you lost 30,000 men on a single day. Bad day for Israel. We, on the other hand, over here in the Philistines' land, have got your God, and we're in charge, and we took your God and we put him where we want him to be. Everyone get the picture? When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face down on the ground before the ark. So that's how we left it in evening. And in the morning, we got up and it was just like this. Everyone get it? Dagon is on his ground. Please understand, this is very intentional. He's bowing before Yahweh. He is in submission to Yahweh. So they rush in, the priest of Dagon rush in, and they put him back up. Man, we've got to pick our God up. Pretty bad day when you have to pick your own God up. This is very intentional language. They rose up the next morning, so this is day two, and Dagon had fallen face down, were on the ground before the Ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off. Now you're beginning to get the parallels, because Eli was on his throne and he fell down and his neck was broken and Dagon's head, get it? And now we're talking about the hands, the right hands, his sons. So now Dagon is back on the ground, only this time his head has been severed and he has no hands. All that's left is just his trunk. Like Eli, Dagon has been dethroned. Yahweh's in Dagon's house, and he's rendered him impotent. Right. Yep. Now, you got to get this. The issue was not that Yahweh was powerless. The issue is that Yahweh had a plan. Right. And now he's in your house. And he's in your house kicking butt. That's our God. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon. After this event, the narrative seems to indicate that whenever they went into the house, that they would take a giant leap over the threshold. Because somehow they thought that the threshold was cursed. How in the world did Dagon end up dead? His head's cut off and his hands are gone. In strong contrast, Dagon, whose hands have been cut off, and impotent Yahweh's hand is heavy. Because the very next verse says, look at this. Now, this is intentional language. Our author is carving out words intentionally. And the hand of the Lord was heavy against... So your God doesn't even have hands, and our hand is heavy. See it? I'm trying to show you how he's crafting language here. And Eli's head's off, broke his neck. Dagon's head's off. Eli lost his hands. Dagon lost his hands. Yahweh's hands are just fine. They're heavy against Ashdod. He terrified and afflicted them with tumors. Both Ashdod and its territory. So we move him into Ashdod. That's where John lives. Gates 4. And everyone in Gates 4 is getting tumors. So coming out of you, and we're going to Hamath next. And we parked the Ark of the Covenant in Hamath, and suddenly now in Hamath, everybody's getting tumors. So nobody wants the Ark of the Covenant in Gates 4, and nobody wants the Ark of the Covenant in Hamath, so we're coming to Fort Bragg next. Well, we're not giving the Ark of the Covenant back up at this point, because remember, this is our sign of victory. We have your Ark. The Philistines... that God previously used to punish the Israelites are now on the receiving end of God's judgment. So previously in chapter 4, God used you guys to judge Israel. But because of your lack of reverence for the Ark of the Covenant and who God is, he's now judging you for your sin. The men of Ashdod saw how things were. They said, the Ark of God must not remain with us. It can't stay in Gates 4. There was an emergency meeting, and all the leaders of Gates 4 said, get the thing out of here. Okay? And so they sent and gathered together the lords of the Philistines and said, what shall we do with the Ark of God? Let the Ark of God of Israel be brought around to Gath. By the way, Gath is where Goliath's from. Yep. So we're moving it from Gates 4 to Hamath. So So they brought it to Haman, and the hand of the Lord was heavy against that city, causing very much great panic, and he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. By the way, isn't it interesting that God is still using human factor, tumors? So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the Ark of God came to Fort Bragg, you get it? I'm trying to make this real, folks. This really happened. This is not a fictional fairy tale of a story. It was a bad day. Every time this Ark of the Covenant showed up, immediately tumors are growing on people's bodies and folks are getting sick and dying. They brought it around to us at the Ark of the People to kill us and our people. They sent therefore and gathered together the lords of the Philistines, send away the Ark of God and let it return unto its own place that it may not kill us and our own people. For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. So does that Dagon have any hands? No, but the hand of God is still strong and powerful. Do you see how the language is being constructed? By the way, when you're teaching Sunday school, teach it this way. Teach the story. Teach your students to see the language. Don't just tell them a story. Actually show them the words in the chapters. Show them how he lost his neck and he lost his neck. Show them how the hands are gone. Show them the details. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. And that's how the story ends. Chapter 6, we're going to give it back. But it's interesting to note that the cry of the people goes to heaven. Not to their temple where Dagon is. Isn't that interesting that the cry of the people goes to heaven? And that's how the story ends. Let's pray. Lord God, bless us this week with your presence. Give us your grace as we go into a world in which Dagon is worshipped. Help us, oh God, never to forget that our God is not a localized deity. Our God is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. He's the sovereign of the universe. His presence transcends the nations. Help us, oh God, to recognize the degree to which you gave a testimony of your very existence and presence to the Philistines, that they saw with their own eyes the validation of the superiority of Yahweh, that from that moment on they were accountable for their idolatry and rebellion against the one true and living God. Help us to realize in this room that we've had the same kinds of testimonies to the legitimacy of who you are in our lives, and our responsibility to serve you in the same way. Give us, O God, faith in who you are. In Jesus' mighty name, amen.